I must apologize to the state of New Jersey right here at the very outset for calling it the instant seat cover state, as we have so often called it. I also want to apologize to the state of New Jersey for calling it the frozen pizza pie state, as we have so rottenly called it on occasions. I must say that I'm very sorry. I would also like to apologize to the state of New Jersey for, from time to time, suggesting that they put on their license plates the drive-in movie state of the nation. I would like to apologize for that, because I have just received an advertisement which is beautifully done and lovely photography that tells me that all the people of New Jersey live in the fresh egg state. Yes, you fresh eggs out there. All you residents of New Jersey, soft-boiled, hard-boiled, poached, how, whomsoever, whosoever, whatsoever, howsoever you find yourself fixed, we can only but stand in awe and salute thee for living in the fresh egg state. I come from, in my long-distant past, the state of Indiana that had a lot of cows. And there were a lot of suggestions that the boys used to make out in the outfield once in a while when they'd slip and slide and try to catch a ground ball off the hop there, as to what the state of Indiana was composed mostly of. And I suppose, in a way, the bucolic beauties of nature are inescapable in these fair United States, where the field of waving grain are forever, ever, ever waving, and the great ocean breezes that bring us the bounteous glory of nature. And so tonight we salute you in New Jersey, you who live in the fresh egg state. My God. And as long as we're apologizing, reset that, Ed. We may need that. Yes, indeed, we will. As long as we are apologizing tonight, I wish to apologize to the New York World's Fair, which has its back up. And the New York World's Fair assures me that it does have a theme. As I said the other night, I was unaware of such a theme. And the New York World's Fair theme is, hold on to your thing out there, peace through understanding. Peace through understanding is the theme of the great New York World's Fair of 1964. Peace through understanding. With the cooperation of Robert Moses and his friends, we will all be peaceful and understand. Yes, and to all other great slogans, we salute thee. Other great slogans of the past that join peace through understanding, strength through joy, and various other beautiful-sounding, wonderful things. And tonight we salute all big, beautiful, wonderful-sounding, big, fat, round phrases. Yes, this summer it will be easy to find peace through understanding as you stand in the shadow of Walt Disney's fantastic recreation of Abraham Lincoln, which you see off to the left with 47 facial expressions and 117 bodily movements, some of them rather interesting. And as you stand before Walt Disney's Abraham Lincoln and reach up to grasp that great plastic hand cleverly heated to bodily temperatures, you realize that peace is possible through understanding. Peace through understanding. Have you ever had the sneaking suspicion that the only thing that ever happens is war through understanding? Literally, the only time the rest of the world was ready to really fight Hitler was when they really started to understand. Peace through understanding is a lovely phrase. Have you noticed how, let's just take little simple human relationships, the little equation that we all live in. How many guys, you know, when you don't know the chick or the chick doesn't know the guy, everything is great. For about the first 4 or 5 weeks, it works out fine until vaguely you begin to understand what kind of a lout you're involved in. You begin to realize the enormity of the mistake you have made. And likewise, he too begins to realize that growing between his shoulder blades is a gigantic plastic monkey of unimaginable size, you. And slowly, as understanding ripens, the knives are sharpened. Until finally, one day... And of course, in America of 1964, these things are proliferating at a frightening rate. The various giant things that have to do with big, fat, round, orotund, lovely, oleaginous phrases. Peace through understanding. I like that. That's a nice one. It really is. That reminds me of the one that my mother used to... She used to stick one over, really. She stuck one over the top of our Crosley radio, which stayed there for a long time, many, many years. And I never quite understood the nature of it, what it really meant. She had it done in cross-stitch, and all it said was, "Look before you leap." Well, I don't know, you know, that hung there. And I, from time to time, I'd ask my mother, you know how kids are, "What does it mean, Ma?" She'd say, "Well, you'll discover one day." I said, "What do you mean, Ma? Look before you leap. You know, it sounds, you know, what is it? What does it mean?" She says, "Well, you just think it over before you make a rash move." And you'd hear my old man storming up the back steps, yelling and hollering after he had bought his 23rd Fiasco used car in a row. He always leaped long before he looked. He was always 30 feet in the air between two buildings separated by 5,000 yards and going down before he ever looked. And you could hear him disappearing into the maw. And she'd say, "Well, there he goes. He's got a Hupmobile this time." And we would all swarm out like locusts to look at the new green Hupmobile that went sideways because of the bad frame. But the old man never saw that because he only looked at the front end when he bought it. It had a great grill. I told you about that Hupmobile the time we rode in the Hup. We bought, we got this secondhand Hupmobile, and we weren't 17 blocks away from Friendly Fred, the used car dealer, when the kids, me and my kid brother in the back seat, were about 5 yards ahead of my father who was driving. This car was that much out of line. We just passed him right up. You know, we were getting to Roseland before him and taking the low road at that. Yeah. All right, gang. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, you set it there. Hold it there, Eddie. Yes, we have a thing here in this country that's really a galloping thing. And it is. You can hardly find an intellectual today, or at least a guy who says he's an intellectual, and there are many who do, who is not agreed that America is the rottenest, guiltiest, sneaky, contriving country on the face of the earth. Absolutely. This is kind of a cant. It's kind of a... It's almost an article of faith. It is much an article of faith as the sun is going to come up. There's no question about it, no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about this. This is a part of the faith. And so part of that faith is we must search within our own ranks. We've got to look in our own ranks. We've got to straighten up what's rotten here before we can say anything about the rotten stuff that's going on anyplace else. We've got to start right here. We've got to clean out our mess. Get after the mess that's within our own body politic and our own crummy, rotten, decadent, idiotic, capitalistic society. Of course, me and my friends, we have understanding and peace and beauty and love and joy. But by George, what about the average American? The average American's a member of the John Birch Society. The average American's a wild-eyed McCarthyite. And they're already Well, it goes on, and it's very hard, because you ask them to go out and find one for you, and they have a lot of trouble. They say, "Well, I know they're there." And so, you know, what's intriguing to me is to find both sides of the political faction as deeply riddled with straw men and scarecrows. Each side is as riddled as the other. And so under every bed, you find the right wing looking for a communist. Under every bed, the right wing believes there is at least seven communists, if not communists, communist sympathizers, by George, and if not communist sympathizers, what do they call them? Dupes. That's it, a dupe, a communist dupe. Well, this is the right wing. Now, the left wing, under every bed, finds a John Bircher, literally, or a paranoid general who wants to blow up the world, namely Moscow. And so both sides are running around like mad, insanely, with gigantic straw men that they continually knock down, bravely, you see, very bravely. And in the middle are 17 million people, billion people, literally, just sort of walking around, you know, and reading Little Abner. Literally. I'm curious as how many actual communists there are in the country and how many actual right-wing fanatics there are in the country. It'd be an intriguing thing to know, isn't it? I'd like to know just how many warmongers there really are. And yet, that's another one of the far left rings. That is one of their giant straw men, that everywhere they see guys who want to go marching off and blowing everybody up to war. They every place they see guys who are nutty about war. Have you seen this, Ed? And on the other, literally. I sat with a guy who had even gone to the point of making a gigantic investment in a play, a big, gigantic, fantastic anti-war plan. I said, well, it's very interesting, you know. He says, boy, that's really going to make him mad. I said, who? Well, it's going to make him mad. Boy, really, it's going to bug him. I said, well, who? Well, you know, you can't say stuff like that like you're against war. And I said, well, Dad, as far as I can remember, the last 5,000 years, there's been nothing but movies against war. I don't recall many pro-war movies. It's been a long time. It's really true. And yet, people consistently see this giant ogre. They really believe that there are millions of people who want war immediately, if not sooner. And they are as hung up as the guys on the other side who see millions of communists under every rug who want to take over the beautiful, free, capitalistic, lovely system they've got and take all their dough. Speaking of hang-ups, by the way, this is WOR AM and FM New York. WOR sees an evil salesman from another radio station under every rating chart. Literally, oh, it does. It's everything that happens is a stinky plot by one of the other stations. But that's true of all these things in this world. But I'm curious, though. I find, of course, you know what happens when you call out a pox on both houses. You are considered a nut by both sides. That if I sit down with one of my really dedicated anti-war, anti-right-wing, conservative, or if I sit down with one of those guys and I say, well, now, wait a minute, Charlie, do you really believe that there are that many people who are anxious and keening for war, and that every last general is a paranoid? They look at you right in the eye and they'll say to you things like, you know, I can't figure it out. You used to be such a dedicated humanitarian. What have you done? Have you sold out? And, of course, hate is pouring out of their eyes. Many guys define humanitarian attitudes as having the proper kind of hate. If you can really hate Welch enough, you're a true humanitarian. The average humanitarian of my acquaintance would gladly see Orville Faubus strung up by 1 foot, dripping tar, with his entrails dragging on the street. And you can measure the amount of his humanitarianism by the amount of blood he wishes to draw from the other side, the evil side. Now, on the other hand, this is also quite true, you see, of the other side. That once in a while, when you find yourself sitting with a real dedicated far-right winger, you will say to him, well, now, wait a minute, Fred. Now, just a minute, Fred. Now, wait a minute. Do you really believe that there are that many communists? I mean, really? I mean, you really believe that Pfeiffer's a communist? Just because he's, oh, what? And the next thing you know, you've got this heavy breathing going, and he says, well, you know, he says, I used to think that you were an American. What is this? Have you gone soft? That's another one of the phrases. Both sides, by the way, use the phrase soft, referring, oh, yeah, you become a soft liberal if you do not wish to see Barnett made into coleslaw. That is a soft liberal. A soft conservative is a guy who does not wish to see all Democrats lined up against the wall and machine gunned tomorrow morning for treason. Oh, we're getting into some fascinating worlds. Yeah, I'll tell you, it's getting intriguing. And so, of course, our time, which is an interesting time in America, and I think which eventually will be written up in gigantic history books, the people will begin to really analyze our time, because one of the things that America is doing that I find particularly fascinating is that America literally today, in this day and age, it's one of the very few countries in history, I believe, that's ever done this. It is taking all the evil that all the other countries have spoken about it for a long time, and not only not denying it, but saying, wait a minute now, you don't know the half of it, boy. You just wait. Listen to this one. And in short, we are the first country, I think, anywhere, that does not look at evil in other countries and, in fact, turns its back on it. I'm talking about among the intellectuals and the writers. Literally just turns its back on it and says, either it does not exist or we have no business talking about their problems when we have problems. This is the attitude. Of course, if you say to him, well, yeah, but then what business do they have to yell about us since they obviously have business? That is beside the point. He says, what is it? Isn't it true what they said? You just can't argue. Have you ever tried to argue with a real dialectic operator? Forget it. It is impossible. You cannot argue with anybody who's really hung on dialectic, with all kinds of little closed box ends to all of his discussions and so on up and down the line. It is always, you know, it's intriguing to a person who, we have it in almost every one of the great areas of controversy in America today, certainly in the race issue. There are fantastic areas of misunderstanding among whites, among Negroes, among all factions. And the loudest man generally wins. And usually, if you are loud and have righteousness on your side, all reason is forgotten, just completely. Just forget it. I sat with one well-known Negro writer who paints all white people as having absolute decadent, rotten, crummy, sinister, jealous, impotent hearts. I mean, they all are this way, and of course, all of his people are beautiful and just lovely. And I said, he's accepted as a great writer. And I says, well, how can you say that? And he started to cry. So that ended that argument. You see, that just, whenever you're in trouble, cry. If you're on both sides, it doesn't matter one way or the other. Cry, and you start petting them, and the next thing you know, you're agreeing with them. You know how like you do with a little, oh, there now, Charlie, it's all right. Gee, I'm sorry I hurt you. There, easy. Now, I didn't mean it that way. I didn't mean you, Charlie. Now, there. And it'll work out all right if you learn. I wonder what a lot of people who do not know many of these people in person, what their ideas of them are. I'm just curious about that. I'm curious what the great rank and file, let's just take average people. What do you think Dave Susskind is in person? Seriously. What do you think, say, Mort Saul is in person? How do you think, say, Lyndon Johnson is in actuality when you're sitting around talking to him? How do you think, these are all good questions. How do you think, say, these are all great national figures that we all know, and people who have, you know, have great following. One of the things that has developed recently, for example, one of the presidential candidates has been campaigning up in New Hampshire. Well, most people only knew this presidential candidate by his written statements. His written statements, which breathe literally fire. I mean, great snorting dragons. Well, in person, he's a very mild sort of bland, flat, colorless little guy. And they ask him questions, and of course they say, I believe we should go, boom, bow, kill him, you know. And he dynamic comes across. And in person, he says, well, just kill him, I think. Now, next question. And so I'm just a little interested in these things. Now, my feeling is this, that the further away you can keep the people, in short, the less you really know about a man, the more inclined you are to assign to him either greatness or total evil. In short, if you don't know a writer and you happen to read his works and have a certain empathy with him, you are inclined to give him a stature far and above that which you would give him if you really knew him. And I'm not talking about closeness breeds contempt. I'm saying it also breeds understanding. And understanding can do a lot of things. It really can. It's as if you have a friend, you see, who because of one hang up or another is a murderer in his heart, literally a murderer in his heart, and given the proper motivation would run amok and kill 45 people in the neighborhood with an axe. And you know it. You know this. You know this guy's a born killer. And because he is a born killer, he has learned since he was 5 to cover this up. A lot of people do, you know. A lot of people learn very early in life how to cover up what they really are, so that by the time they arrive at a grown state, they're such experts at it, you believe they're literally the opposite of what they actually are. And so a guy who grins continually and bats you on the back could very well be the most somber, suicidal guy in the crowd. But he has learned over the years to cover this up by this great big phony grin and this big, "Hello, hello, Charlie," and he's batting you on the back. And so people are constantly surprised when big old smiling Charlie jumps out of a 12-story window. They really are. This happens many, many times. Or the little mild-mannered man who pets cats and is so lovely to little children, one day goes out with an axe and kills 9. Now, which is the real man? Is it the guy patting the little cats and giving the kids ice cream cones? Or is it that one instant when he grabbed the axe and says, "Okay, all right, go," and he goes out with a thing? Which is the real one? And we're inclined to believe that axe murderer was the unreal one. We keep saying, well, he lost control. That was his moment of insanity. He was not himself. Forget it. I suspect that was the one minute in his life that he finally did what he always wanted to do. Really. And so if you have this friend, you know, let's just take it another way. You have this friend who's a real bad guy. You can't raise your voice around him. Anybody crosses him and he's ready to kill you. He's got a fantastic temper, and he writes something down on the paper and he says, "Peace through understanding." And you applaud. There's a thinking man. Whoa. Well, now you wonder, you know, how's the motive there? Does he really mean that? Well, there are a lot of things to be learned through just watching, just looking around you. And yet you find that so many of the far right or the far left both have tremendous straw men, which they continually knock down to great applause. Have you ever known an old-time communist, a real old-time one? I'll never forget this old duffer who I met. I was just out of the Army, and I was involved in working and going to school and one thing and another. And I met a guy who was an old-line communist he was an old writer. He'd written novels, communist novels and so on, and now he was a broken-down news writer. And believe it or not, this guy, in the early 50s, this guy was still back roughly about 1925 in his thinking. He literally was. He could not believe that people were not in bread lines. He wouldn't look at this. No, he used phrases like that. He says, How do you like your father standing in a bread line?" And I says, "Well, my father's standing in a bread line. He's earning like 5 times more than he's worth, the bum. I mean, you know." He says, "Well, yeah, that's him. Why, I've known..." And he goes on and on, and it was a fascinating thing. You could not get through. His thinking was based in some never-never land that was as completely enclosed as Oz, literally. Just completely enclosed as Oz. I have talked to Negroes, for example, who refuse to accept the fact that their lot is a lot better than it was 15 years ago. Because somehow that would hurt them. That would hurt their whole premise of action. Their whole premise would go down the drain. They just refuse to accept it, even though it is quite evidently true. I have met hardline Republicans who are making more money than they've ever made in their lives, who are realizing more profit on anything they've ever had in their lives. They will say to you, "Yes, but this socialistic government is chewing me up. The guy is awash with money, you know." And he still is fighting a fight that goes back so many years that he will not accept and cannot accept the reality of it. Democrats are just as bad. Many a Democrat I know is roughly based about 1932. He is still in the Depression. And if you get him, he'll say things like, "Yes, but how about the monopolies, for crying out loud? What about the little man?" And, of course, the little man, the average little man is now buying his second Volkswagen. He's got the first car, which is a Pontiac station wagon in the backyard, you know, and he's making $12,000 a year. And it's a very intriguing problem when you really look at it and listen to people and say, "Well, wait a minute, just raise your hand once. Have you got a friend who overwhelms you with arguments?" We all have a friend who is a great arguer, who overwhelms you completely, and who is quick to whip out statistics. And you know, most guys they don't invent statistics. You know, the guy who invents statistics is a dangerous cat, who will say, "Do you realize that 3 out of 7 people, according to a recent survey in this country, are earning less than a 17% minus 2% minimal wage? Do you realize that? 3 out of 7. Well, there you're dead, you know. The next thing you know, your boat is sinking and you're bailing. And, you know, of course, you ask him where he got his figures. He said, "Well, I don't know. It was a Newsweek. Exactly what it was. It was in March of, 1963, March of 63, a year ago, just a year ago. Yeah, I keep a file on him." Oh, come on, you're dead, you know. I remember one time doing a show with a great civil rights leader on a television station in Philadelphia, and this guy's in the news right now. And we were arguing, we were talking about things, and he kept quoting famous authors. I mean, like Schopenhauer and Kierkegaard, and he finally made the mistake of running across one that I really knew backwards and forwards. This was the one author that I happen to know a lot about because I had written a paper on it, a whole semester I had spent on this clown, and I had read every lousy, dull word he ever wrote. So he came up with this thing, and he says, "Well, of course, so-and-so says so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so." Well, I rocked back, and I said, "What did he say?" He said, "Well, he said so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so." I said, where? I know all about that." He says, "Well, of course, I'm not sure exactly where it was," And then I began to realize this guy has been fooling people for years by inventing various quotes and inventing augmenting arguments from fictional authorities for years to just overwhelm people. He literally overwhelms people. And many of your favorite arguers, if you'll notice this, are arguers in an old forensic style. They will never answer a question that you bring up. They will always take the offensive. You bring up a question, and then they will ask you one. For example, you will say, "Well, yes, but now just a minute. Now you said that there are certain right-wing nutty generals in America who would love to see a war. Has it ever occurred to you, I would like to ask you a question, do you think there are any in Russia? Do you think there are any in Russia? Could this be true?" There will be a brief pause, and he will say to you, "Now look, now wait a minute, now just a minute, now wait a minute. What about Birmingham? What about Birmingham? What about the bombing of 4 kids in Birmingham?" You say, "Well, now wait a minute. He says, "Yeah, come on, answer that. What about that? How are you going to get out of that one?" And, oh, the next thing you know, you're bailing again. In short, most guys' arguments are based on an interesting concept of arguing. It is to obscure truth rather than to get at it. It is to augment their beliefs rather than to find out what actually is happening. Many people will make the mistake of believing when they're arguing with a really fanatical right-winger or a fanatical left-winger that the guy really wants to find out the truth. Oh, no, no, no. Believe me, you can... I almost came to blows with a friend of mine, a far left-winger, who really believes that almost the entire rest of the country is nothing but John Birch Society members. Literally. And he really believes that every general is a far right-wing fanatic who believes the fluoridation is a communist plot. And he just won't accept the fact that it could not possibly be that black and white, if you'll excuse the expression in these turbulent days. And it's both sides, you see. Yeah, both sides. Oh, yes, I sat with a guy. Yeah, I wonder how many of you have ever sat for 10 hours with an avowed John Birch member. I have. Fascinating time. And as a matter of fact, one of the top organizers for them. And it is really an experience. Really an experience. Like most people who have a certain kind of really fanatical hang-up, they develop a charm. Both sides develop charm. Most of my far left-wing friends have developed a kind of charm to cover up their hatred for the other side. It's a kind of charm. The far right-wingers I know have developed also this charm. It's an intriguing thing to see in action. And this guy, I talked with this guy for about 10 hours. Really, I rode on the train with him. I just sat in the same seat with him. And it was, to me, a real revelation to find that he really did see under every click of the rail, he saw in every house a potential treasonist. He really did. He saw this, and he figured that the whole thing was a plot. It was all controlled by this and controlled by that, that all the press was controlled. All the press was composed of wild-eyed liberals, and they were all there unwittingly to aid the communist. All the way up and down the line, he just could not conceive that these other people have any kind of rational thinking. They're all controlled. It's unconscious, everything else. Nothing about him, of course, was unconscious. He considered everything that he thought pure and beautifully worked out logic. Now, on the other hand, I spent an entire weekend in connection with this show with a guy who was an organizer for a very far left-wing organization. He admitted this, and he had been a Marxist, one thing and another. And again, I rode on the train with him, and again, I talked with him, and I found that his thinking was almost identical with the John Bircher. He believed that the entire press was controlled by right-wing, wild-eyed owners. He believed that every radio station was controlled by a big money guy who wanted to see propaganda for the right, all the way. And it was fascinating. I said, well, how can both you sides believe that the press and radio are both controlled by the other side? He says, that's what they want you to believe. He says, you're a tool of them, too. Well, you know, so, and the other guy, by the way, had said to me, oh, yes. I said, look, fella, I'm not, my radio station doesn't control me. And he looked at me in the right knee. I says, oh, now, wait a minute. Oh, just a minute. This is the Bircher. He says, now, wait a minute now. He says, the reason that they don't say anything to you, because unwittingly, you are parroting the line that they want. Ha-ha, you are a tool. And I said, oh, I see. And so I found myself a tool of both sides, listening to both sides of the argument. An intriguing thing. Now, I just wonder how many people, just, you know, guys walking around the streets, who are involved in their own world, who have their own business, who live in Darien or someplace, ever really have an occasion to spend any time with any avowed people who are dedicated to one or the other of the great causes. Most people read about them. Most people read about, say, a big civil rights leader, or they read about a big socialist leader, or they read about a big far-right winger. And it's really interesting, and I think a little scary, to get involved with many of these guys and find that they think identically. They really do, and they get along greatly. They get along famously with one another, quite often, because they augment each other's misconceptions of the world. And I'm certainly not saying the big middle group of people have a clear idea of what's going on either. But at least they don't have a hang-up. Now, that's the important part. By hang-up, I mean a man who really has a certain kind of neurosis that drives him so much that he wishes to force his concept of the truth on the rest of the world. And you find it on both sides. It's really interesting. I just wonder, out of the 180 million or so people we've got in this country, how many people really are involved deeply? You know, I'm talking about involved deeply enough to do something about it with one or the other of any of the great causes that apparently are sweeping America in a tremendous turmoil. According to all the people in these groups, these are sweeping America. This is what I'm trying to say. Do you really feel that large numbers of the people in the South really do feel that strongly about segregation? Now, or are there just enough people that make a lot of noise that it seems that way to people who want to find it? Curious. Now, I'm not certainly no apologist for the South. Let's take the North, then. Let's take the North. Is the North the bastion of civil rights that we want to think it is? That's a good question. And yet we believe it is. Are there as many right-wing fanatics or people who want to see war or so forth as guys who are continually making peace demonstrations, one thing or another? Are there that number of people, are there that many people around who are for war? How many can you find, you know? How many people are that dedicated to anything, even themselves, that they will march or carry signs? I'm curious how many people who carry signs are dedicated to the cause they carry a sign for, just a question. Really? It's intriguing to find when you get close to any great movement that large numbers of guys in the movement don't even know what it's about. It's just exciting. You know, they're there. You know, it's just a big crowd. They're there. And if you were to stand back a million miles away and see them marching around, you would say, look, there are 275 million people involved in that giant demonstration. How many of them really are involved in the demonstration, and how many are just there? Because people have a tendency to go where the action is. Being people, you know. And you know what's so interesting? What really is fascinating about a thing like this is a thing will seem to be very logical at one moment, and 6 weeks later is totally illogical to you. You wonder why you were involved. Were you ever involved then? Is a question. Really? It's a real question. Let's take this country now. A few years ago, we were involved with a big war. And now it is very, very hip to kind of put it down, to pretend that this war, that it was a ridiculous thing. It was a very silly war. And yet, on the other hand, we are all supposed to be even more angry about Hitler and the Hitlerian mob than ever. Was the war the result of Hitler or wasn't it? You can't separate one from the other. So many of my gigantic pacifist friends are also fanatically anti-Hitler. You know, there's a kind of dichotomy there. You know, I don't know what you say to them. Well, what were you supposed to do about Hitler? Well, that war was different, is the usual answer. Well, you know, this is a hard question to go through. And again, I don't want to sound, if you ever say, you know, if you ever bring up some of these questions, immediately what would happen is that thousands of people say to you, well, what are you, pro-war? Or what are you, pro-Hitler? No. I'm just trying to point out that there seems to be among our, in our world, so many gigantic contradictions within each one of us, literally within each one of us. And, of course, we all have a desire to believe that the enemy that we've created is an enemy and is an overwhelming enemy, literally an overwhelming. There is no feeling, I think, that people have. I don't think there's a feeling that is more sweet than to believe that you represent truth against a great body of anti-truth people. That's a beautiful feeling. You know the feeling of being right? That's a great feeling. And so almost every guy I know takes a stand on a very banal subject, and he will maintain that he's brave by being that way. He will maintain he's brave by being for peace. He'll say, you know, you don't know how, boy, I'll tell you, it's a terrible thing, it's a fight. And there will be guys who believe that they're being very brave by being pro-integration. So being very brave, they really believe they're being very brave. Because they and so when you say to them, as I said to a guy the other day, I said, it's interesting to find out how many guys are suddenly so fantastically anti-war, and yet most of the strategists who are involved in these things and who have analyzed them, do you know that we have never been as far away, literally, from a global nuclear conflict as we are today? What's happening in both sides, are you aware that what's happening on both sides of the Iron Curtain, that it's all beginning to decentralize? There are no longer two big sides. In short, there isn't just us and them. That Russia has got its hands full all up and down the pike. If it isn't beating off Albania, it's beating off Red China. If it isn't getting on the phone and trying to straighten out the wise guys in Vietnam, it's you know, and they're having hassles out in the backwoods with the guys trying to grow the corn. We, on the other hand, are having trouble with France. We're yelling like mad at Britain every 20 minutes. We're on the phone trying to get Singapore straightened out. We're trying. Now look, India, what do you mean, Nehru? We thought a couple of years ago. What are you trying to talk about? For crying out loud. And so what we're winding up with is no sides anymore. It isn't so simple anymore, you know. And yet large numbers of people want to believe that it is still us and them. That would come as a surprise to Mr. K, who has had, believe me, he has had more hassles with more big-time growing-up dictators than we have ever had with K. And so, night and day, both countries are sending out emissaries all over trying to make sure that some little wise guy country somewhere is not going to send 17 gunboats to blow up the cruiser. And it's going on all over the place. So, most strategists say that they believe that literally we are further away from a global war than we've ever been because of this strange decentralization, which nobody's taking into account. Literally. So, you know, how many right-wingers are under your bet tonight, Dad? And say, how about you? How many left-winger comm simps do you see over there in Staten Island tonight? Oh, that place is crawling with them.
This is WOR Radio.